What if actually 45 to 50 is a rough period? You get to 50 and things get better from there. And how do you then, knowing that, how do you consciously curate your life?
Hi, welcome to Resonate, conversations and life lessons from Rancho La Puerta. I'm Barry. Some of our guests come to the ranch because they're going through different transitions in their life. Maybe you're getting married, getting divorced, finding a new career, graduating, going through a health concern. Some of us are even going through midlife crises. Whatever the reason, people come here looking to reconnect with themselves and realize what is important and what is the next step to take. Today's guest has been through several transitions in his life career, and each time he has grown and developed a new pathway. Chip Conley, in his 20s, founded and ran almost 50 boutique hotels in California. Then at the age of 52, he was hired by the three young guys who started Airbnb to be their elder mentor. His current transition has him running an elder academy in Baja, Mexico, and a new one that just opened near Santa Fe, New Mexico. Chip has written 7 books in his lifetime. One of his more recent books, Learning to Love Midlife, is the one I'm really excited to talk about today. Well, hello, Chip. It's nice to actually meet you virtually.
Thank you, Barry.
I've heard all about you. I have never actually met you in person, but I think we've emailed back and forth a few times. So, and I appreciate you taking the time because I've been a really big stalker of you lately. And I see that you're on, I feel like you're on every talk show there is lately. It's crazy.
Yeah. And it's been a really robust time.
Yeah, it's awesome. It seems I was looking at through your life, your adult life. I mean, each little chapter of your life could be a podcast in and of itself, I think. But I also think that the cool thing about getting older is that we never lose those years that we've had in the past, and they all add up to the person that we are today. So I think it would be nice to at least briefly talk about some of those things that you've done, from like having, you know, multiple boutique hotels to working for Airbnb and having the, and I think you wrote 6 books, and you have, now you also have the Elder Academy.
Seven books even. Who knew?
Seven books now. Okay, I missed one somewhere. Yeah. That's awesome. You've been busy guy.
Yeah.
So tell me about how you ended up starting with the boutique hotels and then the transition out of that.
Yeah, so I grew up in Southern California, went to college in Northern California, and knew pretty quickly that I was fascinated by commercial real estate and was particularly interested in hotels. And so at age 26, I started a company called Joie de Vivre, Joy of Life, and bought a no-tell motel in the Tenderloin of San Francisco, and turned it into a rock and roll hotel called The Phoenix. And I still own it 38 years later. And it became the rock and roll hotel of San Francisco. And that was the first of 52 hotels that we created over the course of 24 years in that company. And I loved it. I loved creating boutique hotels. I loved the design. I loved the staff. I loved taking care of people. I loved the fact that a lot of our hotels had really creative entertainers and artists staying in them. But in my later years of running that company, I was done. And yeah, it was hard. The last 3 or 4 years were a rough period for me.
I'm curious about, I have been to San Francisco and I would have never picked the Tenderloin to start a hotel. Why did you pick that area? Is it because it was more affordable at that time?
It was cheap.
I'm
not from a wealthy family. And so I to raise...
Yeah.
A little bit of money to start a hotel at 26, you know, you start where you can. And that was really about it. And so that's how I started.
And then you sold in 2010, is that correct?
Sold the whole company in 2010. Yeah. And then I had a couple of years to figure out what was next.
I think I read somewhere, I heard you say that you had like a near-death experience. Was that a factor in making your decisions to make a shift in your life?
Yeah. You know, I was just struggling in my late 40s. I now know there's something called the U-curve of happiness, and 45 to 50 is the lowest point in adult satisfaction. And I was definitely there, but I didn't know it existed. But what I did know that was that everything in my life seemed to be falling apart. And the Great Recession was coming, and I was running out of money as a hotelier. And I really didn't want to be running that company anymore. I had a long-term relationship ending. I have an African-American foster son who was going to prison wrongfully as an adult. And so it just was a terrible time. I lost five male friends to suicide during this time. And so I had an NDE. I had a near-death experience where I had an allergic reaction to an antibiotic. And I died 9 times in 90 minutes. Fortunately, the paramedics were there when it happened. And so they shocked me back to life. But, you know, when you go to the other side, you have the opportunity to ask yourself, is this the life I want to be living? And, you know, I said no. And so I had to make a lot of really difficult choices during the next 2 years. But I got to the other side of it. I ended up selling the company at the bottom of the Great Recession, and was able to spend the next 2 years after that doing what Mary Catherine Bateson, the daughter of Margaret Mead, calls the midlife atrium, where I had some time and space to reflect on how do I want to consciously curate the second half of my adult life.
Wow. So what if I don't almost die? What is the prerequisite for people to, like, you know, wake up and say, hey, am I living the life that I want to live? Because that's a pretty profound thing to, you know, to die and come back. But a lot of people
don't have the opportunity.
Why that opportunity?
A divine intervention. You know, I think, and this is, you know, we'll talk a little bit about Modern Elder Academy soon, because we get a lot of people who come here who have not had an NDE, but they are absolutely sure they're at a crossroads, but they don't know what to do at that crossroads. So my recommendation is, you know, first of all, people need to tap into, you know, their joy meter and, you know, how much joy are you getting from life right now? And where are you getting it from? And what's one of the most important questions to ask is, if I were to die in a year from now, is this the way I'd want to curate the next year or the next 5 years? If a year sounds too soon, you know, is this the way I want to curate the next 5 years? Let's say if you're to die in 5 years. And for most people, they would say, no, this is not. And that's partly because there's all kinds of obligations and responsibilities.
Right, and so
I'm not suggesting people should run away from those things. But Richard Rohr, the famous Christian mystic and someone who's an MEA alum as a student and also one of our faculty members at our Santa Fe campus, he said, you know, the first half of our life is about accumulating. And the second half of our life is about editing. And so it's right around midlife that we are supposed to learn how to edit and start to look at what in our life is providing us energy and nourishment and what is not. And then you start to curate accordingly. And that's what we call at MEA, we call it something called the great midlife edit. Yeah, it's really important, because if you can't, you know, by the time you get to, you know, around 50 years old, our average age of the people who come to MEA is, you know, 54. But when you're in that era, you got to clear away some of the past in order to make way for what's to come in the future.
You know, I feel that there's a lot of people that are a lot younger than me and you that feel like they're in midlife already.
True.
I think I heard you say before that it's, you know, it's technology and AI and all that stuff is pushing, making people feel like they're irrelevant quicker.
Yeah. So midlife is the life stage between early adulthood and later adulthood. And as I write about in my new book, Learning to Love Midlife, a lot of sociologists say it's 35 to 75, which is a much longer period of time defining midlife than in the past. And that's partly because we're living longer. And the reason that it's starting earlier is partly because people feel like, wow, I feel disrupted by the way the world is. And at 35, I feel old because, you know, I am a software engineer and I just got, you know, disrupted from my job because of AI you know, I'm an advertising executive and I don't understand digital marketing like this 25-year-old, and they just got the job and I didn't. And so, you know, there's a lot. And then on the other side, 75, you know, people are working later and in their lives by choice or necessity. And so a lot of people feel like they're in midlife still in their 70s. So we yeah. better understand this life stage if it's lasting 40 years. But unfortunately, we live in a culture where the only way we think of midlife is as if it's a crisis. And you're supposed to go out and buy a red car and have an affair. And so I think of it as a chrysalis instead. Chrysalis mm-hmm. is the midlife stage between caterpillar and butterfly. It's dark and gooey and solitary, but it's also where the transformation happens. And the U-curve of happiness research shows that after age 50, we get happier and happier. And so I think what I really want people to see is that what if actually 45 to 50 is a rough period? You get to 50 and things get better from there. And how do you then, knowing that, how do you consciously curate your life? And I guess my life as somebody who had that experience is a guide, because at age 52, I got asked by the founders of Airbnb, when it was a tiny little tech startup, to come become their modern elder, what they called mm-hmm. someone who's as curious as they are wise. And so I spent the next 7.5 years with them, 4 years full-time and 3.5 years part-time, taking the company up to its IPO when it became the most valuable hospitality company in the world.
Did they come up with Modern Elder, or did you come up with Modern Elder?
They did. I didn't like it at first, Barry. At first, I was like, you're making fun of my age. And then they said, listen, Chip, you're twice the age of the average person here, and you're our in-house mentor, and we love you for that. And you're a new kind of elder, not the kind of elder that's held in reverence, but you have relevance. And you are not just wise, but you're also curious. And so when I heard that, I was like, okay, I like the alchemy of curiosity and wisdom.
Yeah, I feel that curiosity is something that keeps people young and keeps them.
True.
You know,
our founder, Deborah, is probably the most curious person I've ever met, and she's going to be 102. So
I love her. I love her.
Yeah. So then how did the Modern Elder come about?
So when I was finishing my full-time work at Airbnb, I wanted to write a book called Wisdom at Work, The Making of a Modern Elder, about my Airbnb experience.
See, it's right there on my bookshelf.
Oh, there you go. I love it.
I put it there because I knew I was talking to you.
Yes. And I was writing the book down here in Southern Baja. Now, Rancho is in Northern Baja, and we're in Southern Baja. And so I was on a beach where I had a home on the beach an hour north of Cabo San Lucas, on the Pacific side, Pacific Ocean side. And I went for a run one day, Barry, on the beach, and I had a Baja Aha. I had an epiphany. And the epiphany was, why do we not have midlife wisdom schools? A place where people can reimagine and repurpose themselves and maybe ask these bigger questions. Because, you know, there's not a lot in midlife. There's not schools or tools or rites of passage or rituals. And so what I really wanted to do was create a place like that. And so the first MEA campus was built around my home, right there mm-hmm. on the beach. And that was over 6 years ago. And we've had 5,000 people from 48 countries come to our Baja campus to experience our week-long workshop. And now we have a campus in Santa Fe, New Mexico as well, on a 2,600-acre regenerative horse ranch. It's got two retreat centers on it. And so, yeah, I mean, this idea of MEA is really growing because there's a growing, it's like a movement, a movement of people who say, listen, I may be 50 years old, but, you know, my best years are probably ahead of me. And that is not the way society thinks of aging. And generally speaking, we have a very ageist society, especially in the United States, in which our body defines us. And so, you know, our body gets worse with age. So therefore, we're frightened by aging. And yet, part of the reason I wrote the book, Learning to Love Midlife, was because of the subtitle, 12 Reasons Why Life Gets Better with Age. And what I did was, worked with social scientists and thought about all the people who'd come through MEA and my own story. And it came up with the 12 reasons why life gets better with age to help remind people that, my God, you know what? Your emotional intelligence gets better with age. Your wisdom gets better with age. Your ability to edit the things you don't like gets better with age. Time affluence, having more space in your life, can get better with age if you are editing your life properly. You move from your ego to your soul in midlife and beyond, and that gets better with age because your spiritual curiosity grows. So there's a whole collection of things that get better with age. yes, your body doesn't usually get better with age, but that's only one variable of all of the different variables of one's life.
I was noticing that you had a Baja Aha, and you didn't have to die to have that. So people can have it in other ways. I could go for a jog on the beach and maybe have a Baja moment.
That is exactly true.
Is the campus in Santa Fe going to be, is it similar, the same concept as the one you're doing in Baja?
Yeah, it's the same concept, but there's some differences. Like here in Baja, at the end of the week, if people choose to, there's the opportunity to go surfing and have a surf lesson. Now, you might say like, oh my God, are you kidding me? By the end of the week, a lot of people say yes. Whereas in Santa Fe, they'll have the opportunity to go horseback riding or do an equine assisted learning opportunity. So learning, you know, how to commune with a horse. Santa Fe has a lot more land attached to it. Obviously, in Baja, we have a long beach, which is very wonderful, but we have our own 2,600 acre campus, which is 4 square miles. So just tons and tons of hiking and mountain biking and horseback riding trails there. But the actual core curriculum is the same in both places. The thematic workshops can vary from place to place.
So if someone looks it up, there's a certain theme each week, and if there's something that really interests you, you'd pick that week.
That's correct. Workshops year round.
I spent my childhood close to Santa Fe, actually. So, yeah.
Where?
I went to 4th through 8th grade in Pewaukee.
Oh, I know. Listen, really? Are you? Wow. I've driven through it many times. And why were you there?
My dad worked for the phone company, and we moved out west because the drier environment was better for my mom. So we ended up in. I ended up going to undergrad in Albuquerque. So we, you know, I have a lot of family still in New Mexico. So it's a small world for sure.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to get you out to Santa Fe.
I'll definitely have to come. I go visit my parents all the time. I was also curious. I read something you said that I think what we think is so important and so powerful is our positive thinking. And you said at one point that thinking positive about the latter years of your life can add 7.5 years to your life?
Yeah, this is so our program is really founded on a lot of social science research from Yale, Harvard, Stanford, and UC Berkeley. And Becca Levy at Yale has shown in her research that when you shift your mindset from a negative to a positive when it comes to aging, you gain 7.5 years of additional life, which is more life than if you stop smoking or if you start exercising at age 50. So shifting a mindset around aging is really important, but we have very little in the way of programs to help people with that.
Yeah, I think the US, there's so many anti-aging, and I don't even like that word. I would like to say the passage of time passing
anti-aging is generally a anti-aging industrial complex, which is generally an anti-women complex to make people feel badly about their natural process of aging and therefore sell them products and services around that. So I am of the belief that we need pro-aging products. And I'm not saying products that age you faster, but they're products and services that make you feel better about your aging. And that's what ME is, right. MEA is about.
Oh, I think that's wonderful. So I noticed also in your 7 books that you wrote, as time has passed for you and you have changed, you've gone from like business kind of books into more spiritual, wholesome kind of. That's just kind of how you're like. Is that the ego taking a backseat to the soul?
Yeah, I mean, I think that my books and earlier in my life were at the intersection of psychology and business. And in later life, they've been more at the intersection of spirituality and business and psychology. And yeah, I think that for me, understanding our part in a bigger whole and moving out of the ghetto of the ego is a beautiful liberation. And it is a natural one as well. Although we have, you know, Richard Rohr again says that the primary operating system for the first half of our life is the ego. And then around midlife, it moves to the soul, but nobody gave us operating instructions. And so part of what MEA is about is to help give operating instructions to understand how do you make that shift? And you do so in a way that sometimes it's the circumstances of your life. For me, it was an NDE, but for sometimes it's like a divorce or getting laid off or, you know, having your parents pass away the same month that you become an empty nester. And it's this mashup of transitions that sometimes force people to actually come face to face with the fact that they need to change their life and that change their mindset around their life.
Hi, my name is Jan, and this is my 23rd visit to the ranch. And the reason that I keep coming back is that the ranch taught me about self-care and how important it is. I've come here in many moods and many stages of my life, and if my heart is open and I listen, the ranch always gives me what I need. It makes us to be the most authentic version of ourselves we can be in making little changes in health and fitness and spirituality. The ranch is the place to do it because everybody here is authentic. They're willing to support you and help you in any of your needs or leave you alone if that's what you need to have done. Come to the ranch, you won't regret it.
I hope you're enjoying today's podcast as much as I am. To learn more about our wonderful presenters and exciting weeks coming up at the ranch, go to rancholaporta.com and check out our events calendar. Make sure to mention the podcast when making your reservation to take advantage of a special offer. Some restrictions may apply. I also noticed that you had mentioned some stuff about the difference between knowledge and wisdom, because I have so many friends in their 20s now that they seem to know everything and have an opinion on everything. Now, I just wonder, like, is wisdom examining your life and reflecting and learning from it? Is that what the difference is?
Well, so knowledge is something that you accumulate and you can find on Google or in artificial, ChatGPT. So knowledge is a commodity at this point. And it's not a bad thing. But when someone has a knowledge expertise, it's in a domain. And so someone might be a chemist, but they are clueless when it comes to emotional intelligence. The difference between knowledge and wisdom is knowledge is something you accumulate and wisdom is something you distill. And you distill it and metabolize it based upon your life experience. So when someone is knowledgeable, they are somebody who is smart about a particular topic. But when you're wise, you're sort of, you have a sense of maybe a broader perspective on humanity and life. And the reason you become wise is your painful life lessons are the raw material for your future wisdom. So when I say that is I'm really saying that a wise person metabolizes their life experiences in such a way that actually allows them to be more thoughtful and insightful about their life, and then they share it with others. So wisdom is meant to be a social good. I think we're moving out of the knowledge era and into the wisdom era. And yes, the older you are, the more raw material you have for wisdom. But I know some 30-year-olds who are wiser than 70-year-olds just because they've done a better job of metabolizing their wisdom.
There's a term I've also heard you use. What do you mean by time affluence?
When we think of someone who's affluent, we tend to think of it related to wealth or money. But there's time affluence, which means someone who actually has a lot of time and they like that. Now, there's some people who have a lot of time and they hate it. But generally, I'm talking about the person who really appreciates that they've curated their life in such a way that they have a lot of time. They have the affluence of time. And why is time affluence valuable? If you have time affluence, it allows you to be curious. And curiosity is the elixir of life. It's this thing that actually keeps us youthful. So it's really important to have space in your life to be spontaneous, to be curious, and to be open to new experiences. If you don't have a lot of space in your life, you don't have the space to be curious or open to new experiences or to be spontaneous.
Oh, that's a good point. I think I agree with that. Do you also believe, I believe that our perception about anything creates reality. So I think that I have a lot of friends that, because this is I'm turning 60 this summer, which is shocking, but it's...
You don't look anything like 60.
Well, I'm not 60 on the dating app, so shh. But I think that I have a lot of friends my age and they're just like, I feel like they're 20 years older than me because maybe they're just acquaintances. I won't say friends because they might get mad at me, but because their perception of aging is so different than my perception of aging. I mean, do you think that there is some self-fulfilling prophecy in that?
Yeah. Well, I think that the people I most admire in life as they get older, they're age fluid. So we hear about gender fluidity, but age fluidity speaks to the idea that you are not defined by your chronological age. You because you could have a chronological age and a biological age. Biological age is, you know, how your body is aging. You could have a psychological age or a cognitive age. And so age fluidity means that you are all the ages you've ever been or will ever be. You're not defined by your generation. And you see age as almost like a garment or a uniform that you can take off or put on, depending upon your choices. And so I love people who are hard to define based upon their age. Because it means they're much more interesting. It's unfortunate when someone says, oh, I'm too old to fill in the blank. You know, when I was 57 and I moved down here to Baja and was living here, I asked myself, 10 years from now, what will I regret if I don't learn it or do it now? And I said, well, God, I better learn Spanish because I'm now living in Mexico. And I better learn to surf because I live near a surf break. And so those two decisions at a time where my brain was telling me, Chip, you're too old to learn a language. Chip, you're too old to surf. But that question I asked myself, you know, what would I regret if I don't learn it or do it now, 10 years from now, that helped me to create anticipated regret. And anticipated regret is a form of wisdom. And so we're a wisdom school. MEA is a wisdom school. Mm-hmm. It's a school dedicated to helping people understand how to cultivate and harvest their wisdom. So we ask people a lot of questions and help initiate them into ways of thinking that allows them to tap into their wisdom. And one form of wisdom is to anticipate something, anticipate regret, such that it gives you the incentive to try something today. And so I think we all need that. We all need to be in a place at any age that we feel like we're willing to be a beginner over and over again.
Yeah, I love that, anticipate regret. And then you won't have it if you can do something now, right? Hopefully.
That's right.
Can I ask, this is maybe changing gears a little bit. Do you have a spiritual practice that helps you? Because, you know, no matter what we believe, at some point, this is going to shift to something else.
Yeah. So I have a collection of sort of personal rituals I do. And in terms of my belief system, it probably is most aligned with Buddhism, but I have gone around the world to the world's largest festival, the Maha Kumbh Mela, a Hindu festival. I have studied, Sufism. I'm a big fan of Rumi. And I grew up Christian, Episcopalian. But for me, what's most important is what are the rituals you have in your life that help ground you spiritually. And some of my rituals are things like every morning when I take a shower, I say three prayers and six mantras. Mm-hmm. And I say the six mantras three times. And so that's something that grounds me. I meditate each morning 20 minutes, and that helps, again, ground me. It's like doing some interior decorating of my soul, and that I do that. I go hiking with my dog, Jamie, every afternoon, and I call it spying on the divine, because we go out and I ask nature, what do you have to teach me today? So in terms of spiritual reading, I do all kinds of reading of a wide variety of people. I do Vipassana, long 10-day silent meditation retreats. But I think more than anything, it's service. How do you take the spirit and make it into service? And for 10 years, I was on the board of the Glide Memorial Church in San Francisco, an African-American church in the Tenderloin of San Francisco, not too far from my first hotel. And boy, did I love going there and serving, in all kinds of ways to people who are homeless. And that's, to me, ultimately, when it comes to spirituality or religion, my question is, does it make me a better role model for humanity and for moral beauty in this lifetime? And if it does, then you know, thank God for that religion or spirituality. Because I think it's the actions we take that make the world a better place.
Yeah, no, that's beautifully said. I agree 100%. I also know that you've been fairly vocal that you've had cancer and you've been dealing with that. So how does that all play into that for you?
Yeah, no, I have for 5.5 years now, I've known I've had prostate cancer. It was initially stage one and stage two, and now it's stage three. And when it's at stage three, it means it's spread. It's in my pelvic lymphs. I no longer have a prostate. I've done 36 radiation sessions. I am on androgen deprivation therapy, which is basically meaning I take a pill every day and I have 1% of my normal testosterone. So it's hard. And I think I'll get to the other side of this, but cancer has been a teacher. I think of myself in cancer school. And in cancer school, it means that I'm supposed to learn a few things. Because sometimes the circumstances in our lives that are most painful are the ones that are most meant to teach us something. And so, so what it's taught me is I have sons 12 and 9. I happen to be gay, and I have sons with a lesbian couple who are close friends. And I just feel that much more committed to spend time with my boys. I feel that much more committed to take care of my body. I feel like I don't have to be the hero all the time, and I can be vulnerable. And so all of these things are helping me to feel better about the fact that if I were to die next year, I feel like I've had a complete life. One of my favorite movies of all time is It's a Wonderful Life with Jimmy Stewart.
I watch it every year.
George Bailey, exactly. And what I love about it is, you know, he thought his life was, you know, was a dead end, and, you know, and he was on the bridge going to jump off, and Clarence, the angel, comes down and takes and shows him what, you know, Bedford Falls would look like if he had never lived. And we all need that. We all need this reminder of what is it in small ways, not in big ways necessarily, but in small ways, how have we had an impact out there? And so I think that's part of the reason why MEA means a lot to me right now. You know, as a business person, I focused on ROI, which is, you know, return on investment. But today I focus on ROI, which is ripples of impact. How do I have an impact on people that will last long beyond my lifetime?
Yeah, I think if we're sharing our gifts, we don't even know all the time the people that you touch and the things that the differences you make in people's lives. So if you're living to your true essence and your true self, I hope. Yeah. I like to think that way anyways.
Yep.
So, well, listen, I know that we're probably gone over a little bit, and I really appreciate you spending this time with us. And you're going to be here at Rancho La Puerta on August 31st for a week, and we'll be presenting for us.
Yes. I'm looking forward to it.
I'm looking forward to meeting you in person as well. Thank you so much for spending this time, and have a great summer, and I'll see you at the end of August.
Thank you. Thank you, Barry. Really an honor to be here with you.
I personally had several aha moments talking to Chip today. We were talking about transitions and how transitions are just a part of life. Aging is simply another transition. If you're lucky enough to be alive, this is a transition you're experiencing daily, monthly, and yearly, and it's not something to dread. In fact, Chip says that the happiness curve actually goes up starting at the age of 50. Another thing that I got from our conversation today is that as we get older and perhaps wiser, we realize that our body does not define who we are. I can remember when I was very young reading a quote, and I'll paraphrase it. 99% of who you are is what no other person can see or touch. What a gift that we have these extra time and these years to work on that 99%, which is what is on the inside of us. Chip died and was brought back to life 9 times. My hope is that I don't have to die even once to wake up and embrace my life. Each year, each day that goes by is a chance to grow, to learn, and to serve and share with others. I certainly look forward to meeting Chip in person this August, August 31st, actually, when he'll be here at the ranch presenting. Until next time, This is Barry wishing you health and daily joy.